Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right.
That's right. This is Voices from the Battlefield, and we are going to do it right. We are going to be involved in the struggle for democracy, for human rights. It's, you know, this, we out of control here on this planet. That's all I could say. We got a lot of work to do, but we're going to focus on what we've been doing here in the state of Missouri, or as some people like to say, the state of misery. But we have here with us, and we said we were going to bring them back after the session. And so they are here with us. We have Nisha Smith from Empower Missouri and Kate Mills from Missouri Jobs with Justice. And we just got finished with a brutal legislative session. And the, I think one of the highlights, and we'll deal with some of the good things that passed. But what was so fascinating, of course, was the filibuster. And that was historic. I mean, because I think what I heard was the longest ever. I didn't know if it meant in the state of Missouri or in the country, but one of the filibusters lasted 41 hours, the other one 50. And I was just so proud of our legislators. And I know there were a number of them, but I honed in on my particular state senator, and that's Carla May, because I sent her a note thanking her for standing up for citizens of Missouri. But it was phenomenal. And occasionally I would tune in to hear what they were saying. And I think at one point somebody was talking about Napoleon. So I say, okay, it's still going on. So welcome, Kate and Nisha, to Voices from the Battlefield.
Oh, thank you for having us back. It definitely, yeah, we were at Empower, we were discussing this, and we were like, yeah, so the Republicans had a filibuster that broke Missouri records, and a week later, the Democrats broke that record. But yeah, definitely very, very proud of what the Democrats did, and I called some of the legislative aides to let the senators know, like, hey, we're here, we're listening, and thank you so much. So yeah, this was definitely a session to be talked about.
To be remembered, right?
Yes, yes.
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's been like a roller coaster of a last few weeks of session. You know, we had folks, you know, who've been working to defend majority rule this whole session. They were calling in to their senators the last week of session. And I think it was pretty cool to hear, you know, some of the senators like talking about that and, you know, saying on the floor that they were hearing from Missourians that, you know, that we want to protect our access to direct democracy and majority rule. So,
yeah. And also with this session, I know we broke down the numbers that there were 2,547 bills passed or filed. And the total number of bills passed, not including the 18 appropriation bills, was only 28. Which is a new historic low, even lower than 2020 when they weren't even able to be there. They passed 1.1% of the bills filed.
Wow. And I mean, that's pretty astounding.
It
is.
So,
Nisha, tell us a little bit about why you think that happened.
Well, a lot of it was because we know that the session started with, like the Freedom Caucus, doing some shorter filibusters. And I think there was just a lot of focus on the initiative petitions and infighting, even between parties and people in the same party. And it really slowed things down, because I know with the filibuster towards the end, there were bills that were, that the House had that they couldn't really do anything about because the Senate wasn't working. And I think the overall issue is just showing that our legislature isn't really working for us right now. That's the pressure we need to put on. And I know it was mentioned by someone on staff that when we're talking to candidates, we need to ask them about this and where they stand and what they want to do to solve it. Because 1.1% of bills passed, which meant there were a lot of really good bills that didn't make it across. And yes, the other side of that is there are a lot of bad bills that didn't get passed because of this, but we can't lose sight that there was legislation like Clean Slate and all of that that was really, really close and then just stopped because of all of this. So it's definitely gives us more of a focus on what we need to be pushing for and what we need to be asking candidates. Like, what is your view on this? Like, what are you going to do about it? So 1.1%.
Wow. So Kay, do you agree that the whole thing, I mean, the dysfunction, does that of the assembly, does that favor progressive bills? I know Misha talked about some bad stuff didn't get done, but some good stuff didn't get done either. So is it favoring the not so good stuff? What do you think?
I mean, I've heard some people call the Freedom Caucus the Disruptor Caucus, or the Chaos Caucus, which seems like a good description of what's happening in the legislature. I think that we, because of the dysfunction in the Senate, you know, a lot of attacks on workers and on Missourians were stopped. But, you know, it's not good democracy. And it's a great example of why we need to keep access to the initiative petition process. You know, when our legislature is this dysfunctional, like, we have to get things done. You know, like when we expanded Medicaid in 2020 after 10 years of the legislature refusing to act on it. So
if ever there was a motivating rationale for us keeping the ballot initiative, they provided and have been providing it to us for the last few sessions. I mean, it's just this chaos, dysfunction, and we need more democracy, not less. And it seems like every chance they get, they're cutting us off at the knees so that we don't have full participation and full democracy. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I agree completely with Kay that they basically just showed everyone why the initiative petition process is so vital, because we're the ones that are having to step in and do this work to get these things on the ballot. And, you know, I'm glad the initiative petition bills did not pass, because that means we do get some stuff on the ballot and we get to fight to get people out there to vote and see what happens. So I think it's going to be an interesting upcoming election year, but I know people are mobilized. They're ready, you know, so I'm really excited about that part. We'll just have to take it into our own hands, right, Kay?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would much prefer to be on here talking about, you know, the good bills that we saw pass through the legislative session, you know, things that help benefit working families, instead of talking about the things that were attacks that we defeated or that, you know, didn't move because of dysfunction. So,
but it doesn't seem quite fair. And I know people will say life is not fair. And then they might even say life in America is not fair, but it seems like the work that people like you all do, and then the role that citizens have to play to reinforce what should already be happening, it just seems unfair. I mean, the time that we take, the resources that we expend, when these are things that our elected officials are doing, and to add on to that, you know, the whole taxation without representation. I was totally appalled when the governor sent, you know, $2 million to the border. And I'm thinking, who did you ask? I mean, and I didn't see this whole like opposition to that. I mean, it's almost like, okay, he can do that. That's his part. wait a minute, what does that have to do with life in Missouri? You know, did you all hear any chatter about that in your circles? About that money, yes, the resources that went to Texas?
Well, here's the thing. Oh, go ahead, Misha. Go ahead.
Oh, the thing that I find interesting is people were so focused on the dysfunction and some of these bigger bills and being worried about them that quite a few people in my circle, when I told them about that, they had no idea it happened because it seemed to have happened so quietly. And I told them, said, hey, guess what? While we're fighting, you know, to get more access to property tax credits for seniors, more funding for housing, that they won't even look at those bills. They sent $2.2 million to Texas and they're like, what? People didn't know. And that I've noticed that as kind of a pattern in the last few sessions, that they kind of focus on these big visible things that are going on, that they don't realize the stuff that's kind of happening behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I think that was one of the first, wasn't that the first bill that was passed this year also?
Yeah. The first thing the governor signed.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. Really missing the priorities. Yeah. Before we funded, you know, Medicaid in our state budget, FRA.
Right. Right.
Well, yeah, it's just a sad state of affairs, but it just reminds us how vigilant we have to be on so many different fronts that we didn't know we were going to have to be, doing some of this kinds of work. I'd rather spend my time being proactive on some new issues, not some of these old lingering issues that continue to cripple our democracy. And with Project 2025 on the horizon, I think it's going to actually call for more of our time and resources to beat back some of these right-wing initiatives. But I think one of the things you all were saying is like people, Missouri citizens really responded and they helped to push stuff or stop stuff that we were saying, this is not going to be good for us people. And I know that was the feeling of Missouri Rural Crisis Center, that, you know, they wanted us to thank folks for responding whenever they put out the clarion call, like, we got to stop this bill, we got to stop that bill, and people responded. And as a result of that, that pressure then did have an impact. So thank you, my listeners, because every time I was hearing something, I was like, okay, we got to do something about this. And people were responding, even in midst of their own personal crises and community crises, that people still found time to send stuff to their calls or texts to their legislators. So that's going to be even more important in the coming weeks. So let's talk about what we beat back so they could hear the ugly part that we like just completely smashed. So from your standpoint, Misha, I know you generally do housing, but you know, you all just did a wrap up on Friday. So some of those things, you communicated to your supporters. So let people know what we beat back that could have been very ugly for Missouri citizens.
So one of the biggest things that we beat back, and I definitely want to get a shout out to Sarah Owsley, who is our advocacy director, who put a lot of work into this, was the homeless criminalization and the defunding of permanent supportive housing, new construction bill. She mobilized so many people across the state, and like the Missouri Balance of State COC, people from Mitch, people who were in Senator Rader's district. And so the bill, they passed it out of committee, and initially they did remove the misdemeanor part that, towns, cities, communities could still tell people like you can't camp here, but they removed the part where it would be a misdemeanor. But then it just got to the point when towards the end, Senator Rader tried to add it as an amendment to another bill. It was just shot down. By then it had no power. This is Senator Rader's. She's termed out. And so what we'll be watching going forward is who Cicero reaches out to next. So we're preparing for that. Another big thing that just kind of came up this year were the source of income discrimination ban preemptions. And what the source of income discrimination does is it gives landlords and property owners a lot of power to refuse housing to people solely based on what their income is, and also those that have vouchers. And so it's very discriminatory. And on HB 2385, one of the biggest bills we were fighting, when I testified about that, it was just really trying to give them facts against the stereotypes and the false beliefs they had. So that bill, they try to add it as amendments to other bills, and that just did not happen. And so we're very happy because now it gives us more time to build up our campaign and make sure that when it comes back next year, because we know it will, that we have a very strong base of advocacy. And then I know in criminal justice, there was that big criminal justice omnibus bill. And let me pull up that information. But a few things that happened with, it was SB 754. It did ban that law enforcement cannot issue warrants for traffic infractions anymore, because there are a whole lot of people sitting in jails right now only because they have unpaid fines. And so this stops that. And then it also removed the crack cocaine sentencing disparities, because they would initially give more jail time and harsher punishments for someone caught with crack versus cocaine, which we know has a lot of racial undertones. There's a lot of racism embedded on that. And there's a bunch of other things in that bill, but since I'm not criminal justice, I don't want to try to explain it and get it wrong. And then in food security, our food security policy manager and all of their advocates worked really hard and got the summer EBT program signed and across the finish line. And it's sad that we had a fight to give kids food in the summer, but that one did pass. And so that was a huge win. And so the one thing that we're really proud of at Empower is that even though this session was just so bad and so dysfunctional, every one of our policy areas, we did stop some really bad bills. And then we also got a few across the finish line that we were excited about. Yeah. So I think I jumped ahead into the good bills. I just get very excited. Okay.
Sometimes it's hard to talk about one without talking about the other.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wanted to say something about the housing piece, because I think this is going to be a battleground going forward. I just did an article, because there's all of this tension and conflict around public housing.
Yes.
And, you know, we pretty much, this country is pretty much moved out of the business of creating housing, public housing. Mm-hmm. So it's now moved to the voucher system and other kinds of, alternatives. But here's the problem. The problem is there's not a whole lot of housing, at least not in St. Louis. So you give somebody a voucher, what are they supposed to do with it? And so what it means is people have been stuck in public housing that is unsafe, unhealthy, trying to get the government to be more accountable. And they are not. These local housing authorities basically are just, I don't know if they're just overwhelmed, incompetent, whatever, but people are really suffering. And most of this, again, is based on poor folks and, you know, people of color. So I just see it's going to be a real issue going forward that, you know, folks, landlords are going to get the upper hand in terms of being able to do what they want to do to tenants. And there'll be very few tenants' rights, even though there's somewhere there's supposed to be tenant rights somewhere, but who can enforce them and who does enforce them? So this is pretty bad.
Yeah. And, another thing that, Empower is doing, the other housing policy manager and myself is we are organizing tenant unions and working to empower tenants to come together collectively and see what they can do to change things at a local level and state level, because this is a massive issue. I've been in housing work for a very long time, and the issue is just getting worse and worse, and it's not funded. And that's really what we have to push for from the local level to the federal level, because, you know, most of these programs are funded, federally. And if that money's not coming in, you can't develop the housing. And so, yeah, that's an issue I could talk about for hours, but we're definitely fighting that one pretty hard. So, we're glad that the SOI, discrimination ban preemptions did not pass, because that would have, immediately ended the areas that already have the source of income protections in place. But we know that it's going to be a fight next year. And so we're starting now getting ready for that.
Wow. Okay. So I want to just interject here. Some of Missouri Rural Crisis is, you know, victories, because one of the things that they have been able to do, at least for the last 3 or 4 years, is beat back these foreign investors in Missouri farms. And, again, they were successful in beating that back. But I thought what was interesting is the gubernatorial candidate now is propping that in his TV ads. I'm going to keep out China. And I'm thinking, you know what? You know, if it wasn't for MRCC raising this issue like very vigorously and relentlessly, you probably wouldn't even know that China had his little hands all in our stuff. So that's, you know, I'm just like, when I saw that, I'm like, get out of here. That's MRCC's like narrative. But the other thing that MRCC was very happy about getting passed is that sludge bill. And people may not know what sludge is, but the very sound of the word, I'll let you know, it's not good. It's not healthy. And so that bill passed HB 2134 in 1956 and is now headed to the governor's desk to be signed. So, you know, there's MRCC has been very, very good advocate and watchdog about whatever bills are going to harm Missouri's air, water, and land. And we ought to be very grateful for that, because I think people just take for granted, like, we're going to have clean water and we're going to be able to go to the grocery store and there's going to be healthy food there, safe food there. So one of the things that I hope I got this right, is that they were able to get past this whole thing of labeling, you know, what's in your food. And to me, that ought to be an automatic. And so that has to be a law. they were advocating for that and was able to keep that. Now, why would you not want to know, consumers to know what you have in your product? Come on now. So what you got going, Kay?
So I think, you know, the most positive things to come out of the session for us were how Missourians came together, to protect majority rule and their right to direct democracy and stop these other anti-worker, legislation attempts. So, you know, one of the things that we were following was House Bill 2619, which would have, restricted diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in public institutions. So there was an estimate early on in session that these bills would have cost Missouri like $2.6 billion annually, cost us 24,000 jobs, and like also just undermined the important efforts to rectify racial and gender disparities in Missouri. This bill was sponsored by Cody Smith from Carthage. And it, you know, would have prohibited like all state agencies, including public colleges and universities, from funding staff programs or initiatives associated with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And you know, for us, this, like, these bills are just like those attacks on CRT or the attacks on school curriculum. It's more of a way to attack public and private institutions to disorganize us and divide us and distract us from like the, you know, power grabs that we see happening. So that bill did pass the House, but that it was later on in session and it didn't move in the Senate, although there were some attempts by the Chaos and Disruptor Caucus to add similar language to the budget bills when they were debating those the last couple of weeks of session. And I think we'll see that come up again next session. It was something similar had been proposed last session as well. We were watching, we talked about last time we were together, we were watching House Bill 2218, which was sponsored by Representative Herman Morse. It would have allowed civil lawsuits against an organizer or sponsor of a protest that resulted in property damage or personal injuries. So, even if the organizer or sponsor had no role or even any knowledge, that this was happening, it would have held that, organization or person liable. And we've seen, similar attempts over the last several years in Missouri. I know, Jamali, y'all have worked, hard against these bills as well. I think we'll probably see them come up in Missouri next year as well. This bill, 2218, had a hearing and, lots of good testimony against it in the House committee that it was heard in. And then it never got a vote to move out of committee. So it didn't really go anywhere.
So, Kay, let me say this, because one of the things that I was, when I talked about this bill, I was had to include in the Supreme Court decision on McKesson versus John Doe, which is, the protester, DeRay McKesson, who was involved in an incident in New Orleans, or was it Baton Rouge, but it was Louisiana. And so a officer got injured. And so this lawsuit went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court didn't necessarily rule on it. It threw it back to the lower courts. But what it did is make stand that these folks were going to be accountable. So, I don't know what DeRay's attorney is going to take it, but I saw so many incidents of how wrong this is, because first of all, we always know that when you have a protest, there are people that are that were not invited. There are folks who are provocateurs. You have no control over that when you're trying to do a legitimate nonviolent kind of action. So it makes you unnecessarily and wrongfully responsible for other people's actions. And it just, again, unfair. And I kept thinking, okay, three states were affected by the ruling, McKesson versus John Doe. And we already know in places like Florida, they have signed bills that have pretty much squashed any kind of public protest, because who wants to be subject to that? And so you have to think about all the legal implications. You got all these folks from Cop City that are about to start their trial because of protests. I mean, so you could see the chilling kinds of effect that this one bill can have. And it is definitely from the Republican playbook. It is moving across the country. Some states have been able to, hold it back. Others have not. But I think this is one thing that we really have to keep an eye on. And I was watching the student protest around Gaza.
Yes.
And, sometimes, people were doing stuff that the organizers didn't know anything about, like destroying property and all of that. You don't know who these people are sometimes. And I can say that from somebody who organizes protests. Like, people show up at your stuff.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You don't know who these people are, what they're going to do. As far as I'm concerned, it's the Pope. Least starting mischief. Okay. So I, this is one of them that's just really dear to me, Kay, because I just, we can't allow that to proceed, because I think it just would halt, our ability to even talk about some of these other issues that we have if we need to do some protests. So this is very important to, this is one, just one self-expression in our democracy that must be protected and maintained.
And we use it when our voices aren't being heard, which is, happening right now in our legislature. One of the bills that was filed in 2020 that, didn't pass in Missouri, but was a terrible bill, would have removed driver liability for running over a protester during the protest.
I remember that one. Yes. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. And a couple thoughts on that is, you know, as I follow very closely the student led protest, I'm like, what are the legislators going to bring next year in retaliation to that? And then I remember in 2020, I was organizing and very active in protest. And I can remember there were times of cars coming through. One of the protesters got hit. Luckily, it wasn't severe, but just the idea of like, do we really have protections out here doing using our constitutional freedoms to speak up? You know, and it really does get scary, and having times that people did show up that we knew were there just to instigate and cause issues. You know, so yeah, okay. Those are definitely bills to fight against hard. So I'm really glad those didn't make it through.
But you know, what's interesting, Misha, what's interesting is that there was legislation, I can't remember if it was in Missouri, but there was legislation to protect folks who hit people with cars. So you have these right wingers going through to disrupt.
Yes.
They were going to be protected, but the folks who were trying to do a legitimate one, they're subject to criminal action. It just doesn't make any damn sense whatsoever. Absolutely. Kay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that bill last year I could see coming up again, because it was the one that categorized like 7 or more people as an unlawful assembly and then made disruptive protest a felony with mandatory jail sentences.
Right, right. And these are, go
unbelievable.
Ahead. Yeah. These are things that are, you know, the average citizen doesn't even know about until they get involved in the situation and it happens and like, whoa, where did this come from? Well, it's on the books. They just didn't send you that memo, but it's crazy. And to your point, Misha, about how people are viewing these protests, I started thinking about that with the encampment thing, bills that were originally, targeting the unhoused. But I could see how they could, you know, expand this to deal with encampments on campuses or, you know, public property, or, you know, it's just the expansion, encroaching on our rights as citizens just continues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to stop you from whatever else you have to share. I know we're all very passionate on this call, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead, Misha. Yeah. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, speaking of the Supreme Court and the homeless encampments, they heard a case, on April 22nd, Johnson versus Grant Pass, that we are expecting a decision by June that could completely alter, like, how states and localities handle, the homeless. So basically the case was brought up, out of Grants Pass, that they were issuing fines to people who were homeless. And they kept issuing more and more fines. And of course you can't pay them. And then they would arrest them. And part of it was, if you were sleeping on public property and you had a blanket or a pillow, it was illegal and they would give you a fine. And then people are getting jail time. And we know that being in the criminal justice system makes it even harder to get housed. And so where we're at with the bill now is, because from the testimony, we know that they're not all on the same page, or there's not that typical bipartisan split that we see, but it could be they return it to the states, which means Cicero is going to help them get these bills back on the filed next year, or they could rule that, yes, this is illegal and states have a right to criminalize, or they could say, no, states don't have a right, but we're watching that very, very closely because that, if it passes, could really put an impact on the type of bills they file next year and if they're going to make even harsher language. So we're watching that very, very closely. So that's another case of, you see things happen at the state level and then the Supreme Court gets involved and, you know, makes their rulings, and a lot of people aren't aware that these bills and these cases are being heard at the federal level. So I'm really good at reminding everyone, but just getting awareness that we need to watch that because that could have massive implications towards our homeless population. Because these homeless bills also, it's not the criminal aspect. They want to remove all state funding from the construction of new permanent supportive housing and put it just into temporary options, which do not help the issue. So yeah. I just wanted to put that out there when we were talking about the other bills that the Supreme Court's involved in this as well. And we need to watch.
Yeah, that whole thing about having a blanket and a pillow, that reminds me of the ridiculous and inhumane bills that have been passed in the South that says if you give a bottle of water to somebody waiting in the line to vote, then that's a criminal activity. I mean, really? I mean, this we up against a lot, you all. Okay, what else do you have on your docket?
I was going to mention one more bill, another attack on safety net programs. So there were two bills in the Senate this year that would have threatened our unemployment benefits. They were both filed by Senator Bernsgetter from Jeff City. And it was Senate Bill 745 and 845. So they would have like tied the unemployment benefits to our unemployment rate, which meant that our weeks of unemployment could have been as low as 8, which would be the lowest in the nation. So we currently have 20 weeks, which is still shorter than the state average, which is 26, or the nation average. They were amended, you know, at some point in committee or on the Senate floor to be even worse. So they would have counted like severance and termination pay against your weekly unemployment amount. And we've seen bills like these filed almost for 10 years now. One passed in 2015 and was vetoed by Governor Dixon. But this year, luckily, these bills never got a vote in the Senate. They sat on the calendar, you know, from early on. I think one of these bills was the first bill on the Senate calendar. So the first bill that moved out of committee to the Senate, and they never got a vote. So that is good news, because we count on our safety net programs to be there for us. And yes, they also, like, they just ignore that reality facing Missourians that, you know, some folks have their job opportunities impacted by weather, like, you know, building trades workers, or like supply chain or slowdowns like the auto workers. And also just that, you know, all areas of the state are not the same. So if the state average is a certain rate, that doesn't mean that, you know, the Boot Hill or Southwest Missouri are experiencing the same reality as, you know, the average of the state. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I did want to mention that we did have a bill pass that, isn't the best, but an amendment added was one of our policies we've been trying to get passed for a long time. So HB 2062 is the eviction moratorium ban. They've been trying to get that passed since 2020, basically saying if there is another like mass casualty event, another natural disaster, something like COVID, cities and towns cannot institute eviction moratoriums. It has to come through state law. So that did pass. And I will say one of the things about that is, we know that it would have to be a really big event for that to happen again. So hopefully we never actually have to see this come into play. But we also know that those protections that were in place actually lifted quite a few people out of poverty. But on the HUD website from 2022, once these protections like were pulled away, the rate of people experiencing new homelessness as a direct result of these protections being pulled away and the rents going up is 25%. 25% increase. Wow. In people experiencing.
Now that's criminal.
Yes. And but the language that did get added that has been one of our policy focuses is we did get land bank legislation passed. So we are now going to be building out our education campaigns, going into towns, talking to people about what land banks are, helping them understand what it really is, because there's a lot of misinformation. But this is one way that areas that have more than 1,500 people can take those spaces, you know, maybe like, places where they tore down a house and it's just weeds or falling apart. They can use that to make it a community space or a green space. They can take, houses and buildings that are sitting empty due to back taxes, foreclosures, and they can purchase them, at a lower rate and get them back into use and turn them into housing. So it can do two things that we're happy about. It can make it easier for someone to own a home, or it can also be opened as an opportunity for affordable housing. But a policy thing that we're going to be looking at over the next few years is definitely having to institute, see what we can do about zoning. Inclusionary zoning. That's a big thing people talking about. So we did get land banks across, and, you know, that's just one more step to hopefully expanding, housing opportunities for people. So we're excited to see what happens in communities. And it's also been shown that land banks really can help smaller communities and rural areas, which often too often seem to get left out of the discussion about this. And we're trying to make sure that they're included. So yeah, we were excited about that. And, it got added as an amendment to a bill that we really did not want. So we were like, we love this part and we really don't like this part. So here we are, but that actually had bipartisan support. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the bipartisan support, we have to remember, not everyone wants to use it as a means for affordable housing. And that's why we're going to make sure our education campaign really discusses all of that and what it looks like, and get feedback from communities and understand like what is holding them back about it or what they don't understand. So, you know, as we all know, I'm sure Kay knows that even when the session ends and you get some stuff across, that that just means that you now know what to work on next. It never, ever stops. We're already looking to 2025.
But I'm thinking with a number of these issues, but it seems like particularly with housing, that this sort of piecemeal reactive approach is not getting to the heart of the issue. Now, I know in St. Louis City, you know, the encampments that were in front of City Hall and in front of another public building, they have been fenced so that people can't do that. And I'm thinking, well, we're doing is moving people around like unwanted trash. Can we resolve this problem? I mean, right. We don't have near the problem that LA has or New York City has. Why can't we wrap our heads around this issue and come up with a solution that makes sense? And it just baffles me. I'm just like, okay, you can't get here. You can't be here. If we see you doing this, you're going to get a citation. If we see you doing public urination, you're going to get a citation. It's all about criminalizing people as opposed
right.
to let's get to the root cause of this and see if we can get some housing for these folks. So yeah.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the study after study after study shows that the solution to this is housing, but the idea of what stops people from supporting it and what we really have to work to address is people are like, why should we give them housing? It's the idea of, I worked hard for this. Why should we give someone that? And there's a lot of misunderstanding. And we have the same encampments in Kansas City. Our problem, our homeless problem is it's dire. And our city hall, we got big fences around that too. But you know, that's something that we're going to be working on at Empower Missouri, because Missouri, we have the highest rate of rental increases in the country, and out of metro areas, Kansas City has the highest rate out of all the metro areas, and our homeless population is just growing. And so we're definitely, you know, not just looking at the bills, but also looking at like what education needs to be out there to break down those stereotypes and bring people together to see why these solutions work. You know, it's really got to be about building those relationships and not doing us versus them. Because a lot of times when people are pushing back against this, it's because they don't understand or it comes from a place of fear. And you really have to sit down and have those talks with them, which is something we're going to be doing a lot with the tenant unions, mm-hmm. doing a lot of work around canvassing and knocking on doors and meeting with people and having conversations and seeing what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good luck on that. And before Kay, I ask you to talk a little bit about the petition drive that, again, thankful for the ballot initiative that, you know, we collected mm-hmm. over 200,000 signatures. But I do want to say that one of the critical issues that St. Louis was really concerned about was taking away local control of the St. Louis Police Department. And this also is an issue that keeps coming back like a bad penny. But we were able to beat that part back. But the legislator did undermine some of the existing ordinances that would help the citizen involved part of these citizens oversight board. They tampered with that a bit. So we have to really look at what that means going forward. Does it completely gut the civilian oversight board? Because one of the things that we have been fighting for is that, and these people like often will campaign on this. We want citizen participation. We want be involved. This is your government, the people's house, yada, yada. And then when you start to say, okay, let's do this. I want to be on this committee. All of a sudden there's all these barriers and we're like, okay, this is going to be a problem. But, you know, thank goodness we beat back this whole notion of local control because again, St. Louis and Kansas City were the only two cities in the whole damn country who did not have control over their police departments. Now we pushed it through on this end. At the time that we were doing it, Kansas City said, we're fine. We don't need to be a part of that. Well, now they have openly told me they wish they had not passed on that because they're having problems with their police department now. But again, why are you going to deny citizens local control? And these bills were being put forth by people who don't even live in St. Louis. You know, what the hell do you have? What do you know about what's going on here? And as I think the mayor and other city officials says, the crime rate is the lowest that it's ever been. So what's your rationale for doing this? Except we know that the real push behind a lot of the bills that have anything to do with the prison industrial complex, you know, which is, you know, the court reform, police accountability. Who's behind those blockages are the Fraternal Order of Police and local police unions. And so wherever those things hit a wall, you can best believe that they've been there doing their lobbying. And so they weren't successful this time, but they got plenty of money and resources to come back again. But I think we are going to have to put some measures in place that says the citizens are, that's the top of the line, not necessarily elected officials, but those are the people who these things impact on a local level. And so we're going to continue to push for that. I know the Organization for Black Struggle ran some ads in the St. Louis American, and we talked about this is not a confederacy. You know, you all must come forward to the 21st century here. This is not a place where, you know, the landowners and white males get a chance to say what folks are going to do. So it's just a lot of different issues that are entry points for people wanting to get involved, and they really do. And we want to make sure that they have the ability and the rights for them doing that are upheld. And so right now it seems like there's all these doors being closed for people to fully participate in the government. And we are not going to stand for that. So, Kay, if you will talk about the efforts around the ballot initiative, which I think was very successful. And so I know we're waiting to hear if those signatures have been certified, but I'm already ready for the outreach and get out the vote part, so that we get that passed. So talk a little bit about the paid leave, and wage increases that were part of that ballot initiative.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. That is exciting and an example of, you know, proactive pro-worker legislation, that we move through the ballot initiative process when our legislators don't listen to us. So, on May 1st, we turned in over 210,000 signatures from around the state, of folks who said they wanted to see this issue on the ballot. So it will raise minimum wage to $15 by January 1st of 2026, and then also allow workers to earn paid sick time as they work. So 1 hour of sick time for every 30 hours worked, up to about a week for small businesses, and a little bit more for larger businesses. So it'll make a huge difference for folks in Missouri. I think there are almost a million, over 900,000 workers who don't have earned paid sick time right now. And, you know, several hundred thousand Missouri workers will also get a raise through this. So
this is going to be important, Kay, because the way that we work our people, they are going to be sick. They are going to be stressed out. And so them having this kind of benefit is hugely important, hugely important.
Absolutely huge. Yeah. You know, people shouldn't have to choose between, you know, being sick and getting a paycheck, you know, making those really tough choices. So I shouldn't have to go to work sick.
Oh, 100%.
Right. And I know at the celebration that JWJ had here, we were trying to get clear on what election is going to be. Is it going to be August or November? And so, of course, it would be better to have it in November. But, you know, whatever it is, we're going to have to rev up for it. So when do you think we'll know that, which ballot it's going to be on?
I think, if I'm right, I think we should know this week. Which ballot it's on, because I think that they have to announce that it's going to be on the August ballot if they were planning that. So I'm right about that. But I you know, likely November, voters will see this on the ballot. And then the first minimum wage increase would be in 2025. And then it would go up to the full 15 by 2026.
Yeah. Go ahead, Nisha.
Oh, I was going to say, we'll definitely be watching that at Empower Missouri so we can make sure we get it out to our coalitions and members if they're aware. So that's exciting.
It's hugely exciting. Now, here's what I hear from folks who support, you know, this. It's like, why can't we, instead of every few years, we're having to put this stuff on the ballot? Can we not have a ballot initiative that includes cost of living and inflation rates so that, you know, because by now when we were fighting for $12 back 10 years ago, now that's like nothing. I mean, so if we're really going to talk about a livable wage, can that not be part of a ballot initiative so that we don't have to do this every time? And I know I've raised this before, and then somebody said, well, the polling says this, but people are, you know, get pretty weary. Like you're working hard and inflation is going up, but you know, you fought for this increase in wage, but now it's like almost back at minimum wage again, and instead of a livable wage. So how do we deal with that, Kay?
Well, the way this one is written, it does continue to increase annually with the cost of living. I'm not sure exactly how that's calculated. So I'm not sure if I don't want to say I just don't know, but it does increase with the cost of living.
Okay. So with our last few minutes here, are there any bills that we should be concerned that could get vetoed? You know, right now the session is over. Stuff is going to the governor's desk to be signed. The way the law is, if he doesn't sign in a certain time, it still gets, you know, put into law. But there's also some veto stuff that could happen between now and then. So anything that we should be looking for that's on the horizon that we could alert our listeners, like we got to be concerned about this because there's already rumblings about a veto. This of good things that we got passed that could be like, you know, smashed down the line. What do you think?
Oh, I've seen some articles where Governor Parsons has stated that he thinks the budget is unacceptable. So I'm very curious if there's going to be anything in that he's going to veto. Waiting to see if that will lead to them having to come back to a special session or not, because I know the whole budget process like that had a lot of issues, but I'm very curious about what he will do with the budget, that's where I'm at. So, and the bills that I really wish he would have vetoed, he's already signed. So, the budgets. Yeah. So the biggest thing I'm going to be watching is just seeing how he handles the budget, because that's been a big tension point between him and the Republican Party. So it'd be, that's what I'm watching.
Hey, Misha, if there's a deficit of more than $2 million, I'm going to tell him, go back to Texas and get our money back.
We want a refund. Yeah. Yeah. I'm telling more people about that because I think they need to know where.
Yeah, that was definitely under the radar. Yeah.
And yet we're still fighting for, you know, fight to get kids better resources for food over the summer. So that's where we're at. But we won that one.
Yeah, for sure. Kay, what about you? You see anything that we need to be looking at that could get iced before it even gets to see the light of day? Or, and I would also include any legal challenges of things that have passed.
You know, there were two bills that we wish the governor had vetoed that he signed before the end of session. One was Senate Bill 727 that moved public funding for education to our private, you know, tuition tax credit style voucher system. So yeah, Senate Bill 727, but he did sign that the last week of session. And then there was also a bill that blocked, funding to Planned Parenthood for, birth control, wellness exams, STI testing and treatment, and cancer screenings, House Bill 2634. And he signed that bill, late in the session, even though we wish that he had vetoed that, because we, you know, we have a big, you know, issue with healthcare access in Missouri. You know, the wait list for patients at public nut clinics can be weeks or months, but, the wait time at Planned Parenthood clinics was much shorter and people were able to get in and get access to those really essential healthcare services.
That's when you could see when certain, sectors are targeted, because you've already defunded them in terms of abortion. You made that illegal. But there's many other services that are there that now they're saying, we're not going to even allow you to do that. I mean, I just don't know what the future of Planned Parenthood is based on that kind of funding being snatched from under them that has nothing to do with abortion. It's so illogical. Like,
it's driving bad health outcomes for Missouri people as well. You know, in Missouri, people on Medicaid are 10 times more likely to die within 1 year of pregnancy than those on private health insurance. And that was from a study from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services. And that's really terrible.
The defunding of Planned Parenthood, as far as Medicaid, I do expect that to become a legal challenge in courts. So I'll be watching to see what happens with that, but I fully expect Planned Parenthood to take that to court because they used a lot of fear mongering and inaccurate information. So, hopefully that gets into the courts, but we'll see what happens there because you never know.
You know, I just, every time I see these folks and how they operate, and I'm thinking, okay, I know you all have an agenda and I know that it's anti-black, anti-women, anti-gay, anti-immigrant, I mean, a lot of antis in there. And so with this particular one, it just seems a very heavy-handed approach to making sure that institution like Planned Parenthood is history. And I think it's on us whether we believe in abortions or not. We still have the overarching banner that says women have the right to choose. And it's not just anti-abortion, or pro-abortion, but women ultimately have the right to choose. And so when you start taking services away that compromise their health and well-being or the well-being of their children, it really does cross the line. And just the way I look at it, it crosses the line. And it's beyond some kind of ideological battle here, some kind of political turf thing. You all are just being wicked and vile. That's the only way that I can look at it. So yeah. So I want to thank my guests today. You all have helped us stay on top of this legislation. I thank you for what you do, because I always tell you that is indeed a swamp down there, and you all have to put your toes in there and see what's going on, so that you know what stuff to bring back to voters and citizens in the state. And so it's, the job seems to get harder and harder. And so I just applaud you all for the work that you're doing and keeping that eagle eye open for the rest of us.
And thank you for having us on and helping us get the word out and the work you're doing, because it's definitely going to take all of us in all the sectors across the state to fight this stuff. So thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to come chat with you guys.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jamala. Look forward to continue to have these conversations, make sure that folks know how their elected representatives vote on these issues, and keep, you know, like you were saying, Misha, keep having those open conversations to kind of get past the things that divide us and find out what we have in common instead.
Absolutely. So
And I'm just going to remind my listeners that if you missed a particular show or you want to go back and hear it, just go to JamalaRogers.com. And I'm thinking that you might want to check this show out again as we, in the next month or so, to make sure that all our stuff stayed intact. And also even when we get ready to go into the next session, like, what are we saying we passed and didn't, and that they might bring back? We got to keep our eye on that. So I just think this is going to be one of those shows that people will go back to again and again, and I have no problem with that. Yes. So thank you for listening. This is Jamala Rogers, your host. Thank you, and we'll see you on the battlefield.
Right now, the time to do the right.